Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Last weekend I was teaching a retreat for the Buddhist Society at Safety Bay, and I'd like to elaborate on a few of the points that came up from that meditation retreat. Trying to understand what it is that we're doing in the practice, what we're trying to accomplish, especially what we're trying to accomplish in terms of the mind. And the theme for the retreat last weekend was trying to become consciously aware of what is going on in our mind and what we're doing with our body. We have to get to know both the mind and the body because they play off each other. They interact with each other constantly. And one of the ways that we can focus our attention is to focus on the body because it's such a gross object. We focus on the movement of the body in the change of postures. We focus on the movement of the body when we're walking, particularly because this is something that we do many times throughout the course of the day. And if we focus our attention on the body and the movements that we're making, not only in walking and change of postures, but in any activities that we're doing, when we really pay attention to that, it helps us to come into the present moment, what is happening right now. Not only with the physical body, but as we attend more and more closely to what we're doing while we're doing it, becomes easier for us to tune in to what's going on in the mind as well. One of the questions we ask ourselves is not only what am I doing, but with what mind am I doing this? Am I doing it paying full attention? Am I doing it with a worrying mind? Maybe not worrying about the activity that I'm doing, but worrying about something else. And because I'm worrying about something else, it means I'm not paying full attention to what I'm doing. And that affects what I'm doing, even though it's got nothing to do with what I'm worrying about. With what mind am I doing this? And we see that the kind of mind that we're using, that's present while we're doing this activity, affects how well we can do the activity. If we're worrying, we might be very tense. Our muscles are very strained, and we find that we're putting in much more force than we need to do to accomplish the task that we're doing. Cleaning our teeth, typing into the computer, instead of doing it in a relaxed way, we're doing it with a lot of tension. That mental state expresses itself in the body, and because we start to feel so tense and tight, we feel uncomfortable, we start to get upset about that, the mind starts to get tight and tense, and one thing leads to another. The mind and the body, as I said, play off each other all the time. And not only are we getting tight and tense in ourselves, but but when we interact with someone else, because we're tight and tense, then that's what we express when we speak to someone, when we respond to them, our own tightness and tenseness, which maybe has nothing to do with them, and maybe has nothing to do with the task at hand, but is something else that we're worrying about. And this is the process of cause and effect, the chain reaction that takes place in our experience moment by moment. And in the practice, we're trying to become consciously aware of this. First of all, to know it, then to see whether it's good for us, whether it's helpful, and then to see what we need to change and how to do it. And then to see if we do change and what happens then. So Achan Chah gave a simile that this is the mind which is able to become consciously aware and is able to observe the process of our experience is like a bridge that is built over a stream. The bridge is steady and stable, while the water that flows under the bridge is constantly moving. It's flowing from one direction to the other, and it's also rising and falling depending on whether it's being fed by a spring or whether it's raining or whatever. There's constant movement in the water, but the bridge remains stable and steady. And this is like the mind which is able to observe the flow, the process of our experience, which is both mental and physical, both contained within this physical form, the sense bases, the ear base, the nose base, the tongue base, the eye base, the body base. These are all contained in this physical form, but they're the doorways through which we receive data from the environment and through which we interact, we give our reactions to whatever it is that we receive. And the interaction between the internal and the external environment is compounded by what's going on in ourselves, what memories come up, what emotions arise, and how that affects us. So if we think of something sad, then we produce tears. So the thought, the mental aspect, produces a physical change in the body. And this is a very gross example, meaning a very easy one to understand. But this kind of thing is happening within us constantly, moment by moment. So to be able to observe that flow of our experience and the rise and fall of our experience without getting swept away by it, that is what we're trying to develop in developing a stable, steady, conscious awareness of what's going on. We have to understand that this flux and flow, which we call my experience and which we think of as me, pertains also to the bridge. That is also arising and passing away, that knowing experience. But like the bridge, it lasts for a lot longer. It doesn't change as quickly as the water that passes underneath. At the nuns' monastery, we have a number of streams on the property, and we have a number of bridges that volunteers have built for us, and people have contributed the materials for those things. And one of those bridges was hit by a very big branch of a wandu and smashed to bits, even though it was very sturdily built. And that's a very good reminder of the fact that even the bridge doesn't last forever. Even the bridge isn't impermanent. So that knowing quality in the mind, that mindfulness with clear comprehension, sati sampajanya, also is subject to change. That's why even in the meditation, we know that we can sit for a little while watching the breath and observing thoughts coming in and going, and we just observe them. And then, before we know it, without realizing it, we're actually in the middle of the thought. We're actually thinking it. We lost our mindfulness at that moment, has gone. As soon as we realize that's what's happened, we re-establish mindfulness. Just knowing that's what's happened is actually mindfulness re-established. So this knowing quality is something which comes and goes like everything else. And so our practice, our work, is to develop it, make it stronger so that it lasts longer and longer. That it lasts longer and longer over time, and it becomes capable of seeing more clearly what it is that's going on. As we strengthen that quality of mindfulness, it not only lasts longer, but it becomes sharper, more able to see in detail what's going on, rather than catching things after the event, catching them after we've already reacted and said something that we wished we hadn't. Mindfulness becomes so sharp that we can even feel an emotion arising before it's fully blown. And we can feel whether this one is dangerous or this one is helpful. And we can catch it at that point without feeding it, without encouraging it, before it gets so strong that it overwhelms us. To develop the mind to this extent requires not only the practice that we do in the meditation, but it requires the whole of the work involved in cultivating the Noble Eightfold Path. It's very important that we understand that this mind that arises, the bridge, is built out of many different aspects. It has many different materials in it. They all need to be present if that bridge is going to be strong enough to stand up to the flow of the water and stand up over time. And just as any bridge, whether it's made of wood or made of wood and metal, has many component parts and they all need to be in good working order, so our practice is made up of many different component parts, not just what we do on the meditation cushion. And one of the similes that I've been giving about this is it's like someone who's training to become a leader, a winner in their field in sports, for example. And the example that I was giving was of a weightlifter. There's a lot of work that the weightlifter has to do outside the gym in order to develop their body and their mind to the point where they can lift the heaviest weight. When you're beginning as a weightlifter and you see the heavy weight that other people can lift, or that they say someone can lift, you might think it's impossible for anyone to lift something as heavy as that. I don't believe them. They're crazy. I'll never be able to lift it. But we know that there are people who have extraordinary strength and capabilities to lift things which do seem impossible to the ordinary person. Now this is an analogy for what we're trying to do with the mind. The ordinary mind is like the person walking in off the street and saying, I want to become a weightlifter, and then being confronted with the fact that there's a big difference between what I can lift now and what someone who's trained and practiced can lift. In order to be able to lift that weight, the weightlifter has to not only start to build up their muscles, they have to build up their stamina, they have to watch their diet, they have to make sure they get sufficient rest, they have to get the right instructions so they have the right technique, and they have to start with small weights before they can lift that heavy weight. If they don't do the whole training, they might be able to improve their muscles somewhat, but they will never get to the champion level. A lot of what they need to do has to happen outside the gym, and only when they persist with all of the component parts over time do they get to the point where they can start to move those heavy weights. In the spiritual life, going to the gym and trying to lift the weight is a bit like our meditation practice. It has to be supported by so many other aspects in order for the work we do in the gym or on the cushion to really pay off, to bear fruit. Now, interestingly enough, I read in the newspaper recently that there was a champion weightlifter who is in the top ranks in his weight, has represented Australia at the last two Olympics, and was considered to be a certainty to win a gold medal in his weight at the Commonwealth Games. And just recently he's been tested positive for taking illegal substances. Well, this is what he's accused of doing. And this is the second time he's tested positive, and it's automatic life ban if you're tested positive for the second time. Now, for all the work that he's done to accomplish his goal, and he's succeeded very much, something that he's done outside the gym is going to determine whether or not he reaches his goal. And I thought I was using the idea of the weightlifter in the weekend retreat before I heard this news, but this is a very good example of how it doesn't matter how good we are and what effort we put in one area, if we haven't got the whole package, we can undermine all the effort that we've made so that we don't get the result that we've been working towards. Now, in the Noble Eightfold Path, one of the components, the essential components, is virtue, morality. And this means being a good human being, living a life of integrity, being someone who's tries to live harmlessly, lives in a considerate way, considerate of themselves and others, of the environment, the material world, animals, every other being that shares this world with us. Trying to develop qualities like generosity and kindness, courage, perseverance, and refraining from following our instincts, particularly the instincts for self-centered gratification of desires, going after what we want, no matter what, even if it hurts ourselves and hurts others. This is the first aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, and unless we cultivate those qualities, and unless we place the mind within the boundaries of the five precepts, then we'll find that we can never progress in developing the mind in meditation, because we'll always be troubled by worries and fears about the kind of things we've been doing off the cushion. And it may not be terrible stuff. We may have a sharp tongue, and it gets us into trouble day after day. we might exaggerate, like to add a little bit to whatever it is that we're telling someone. And it gets us into trouble day after day. It gets us into trouble because we know that we're lying, or we know that we're exaggerating, or we know that we haven't been able to control our tongue again. And so that makes for discomfort internally. We feel it in the body and it affects the mind. And when we sit down to meditate, it takes us so long just to process all of those events from the day. And not only does it take us time to process it, but it agitates the mind. It stirs up the mind. It takes the mind in exactly the opposite direction to the one that we're trying to go in, which is to still the thoughts, allow the mind to become calm and peaceful. Because when it's able to stop, peacefulness, happiness arises naturally from within the mind itself. So that inner turmoil that's created through unskillful living doesn't just go away when we sit on the cushion. It's our experience when we've got nothing else happening. Those things are exaggerated and they disturb the mind. So just like the weightlifter, doesn't matter what you do in the gym, if you haven't got it together in the way you behave outside, then you're undermining your chance of success. One of the component parts that the Buddha said is essential if we're going to allow the mind to settle down is called guarding the senses, protecting the mind from those things which disturb it even more than it already is disturbed just through the normal things that we come in contact with, that we see, that we hear, that we're involved with in the course of our daily life. Guarding the senses means recognizing not only the amount of busyness that we expose the mind to, but also the quality of the contacts, the quality of the things that we expose the mind to. And again, it may not be drastic stuff that we're exposing the mind to, but if we're the kind of person who tries to squeeze as much as they can out of every minute of the day, thinks that they can't afford to miss one single thing that anyone else is doing, if we chase after experience, we'll find that we never satisfy the desire for experience by doing that. We just wear ourselves out. And if you're young, you might think, well, I'm not worn out yet, and while I've got the energy, I'm going to make the most of it. Fair enough. But we can experience for ourselves, especially when we do start to try to develop the mind in meditation, that the mind is very often fatigued. And not necessarily because we've been working very hard physically, but because we've just been expecting the mind to go non-stop from the moment we wake up till the moment we go to bed. And we'll find that even when we go to sleep, we don't actually give the mind a good rest. In sleep, we mull over the day's activities, what's happened to us. The Buddha described this as being like an anthill that smokes during the night and flames during the day. What happens during the day stays in the mind and gets processed during the night. We think we're going to sleep to have a rest, but that's not what happens, particularly when the mind is overstretched. And so if we want to help the mind relax in the meditation, if we want to be able to refresh the mind in the meditation, then we have to be careful about what we expect of the mind during our waking hours. Because of internet, because there's no time limit to what we can do, we can be on the computer at all hours of the day and night, because always someone somewhere is awake these days, we find that we don't give the mind the chance to stop. And people, not just young ones, people confess that they're regularly up till 2 o'clock in the night playing computer games with people on the other side of the world. And they know they're fatigued, but they just can't stop. And when the mind is fatigued, of course the body's fatigued. Once the body's fatigued, the mind is fatigued. And once we're fatigued in that way, then we're much more vulnerable to illness. We can't squeeze as much out of the mind and the body as we would like to, because desire knows no end, knows no limit. And that's why having more and having access to more things only creates more desire. Doesn't lead to satisfaction. Guarding the senses is something that we need to do outside the gym. We need to do it off the cushion if we're going to help the mind to settle down in meditation. When we are not meditating, when we're away from the cushion, it's not only the time to practice cultivating virtue and guarding the senses, but it's very often when we're going about our daily life activities that is the place where very often our insights into ourselves and into the Buddha's teaching really start to reveal themselves. Because we're starting to pay attention, because we're starting to be consciously aware of what's really in our mind when we're in that situation, how we really feel about that person, we start to get to know ourselves much better. We think we know ourselves, but often we only know the bits of ourselves that we are willing to acknowledge, willing to look at. The bits of ourselves that maybe we can't avoid facing. So, for example, when we can't turn off the computer, when we can't say no to desire, what do we tell ourselves about that situation? Can we be honest and say, hey, I've got no control here. I'm not able to say no, even though it's really in my best interests? Or do we tell ourselves a story about why it's really important that I finish this off, or that this is really helpful, or this is really fun, or this is really good for me, or I can't let the other person down on the other side of the world, or whatever it is? Do we really know what's going on? What's motivating us in that moment? We might have lived our life always being able to come up with a good explanation, a plausible explanation. We almost convince ourselves. We may have convinced others. When we start to cultivate this path and we're trying to develop honesty, first of all, it's honesty with ourselves. When we're trying to develop clarity, it's clarity about what's going on internally before we try to sort out other people, try to know what they're doing. So getting to know ourselves happens very often, mostly outside of the meditation practice. And this is the other aspect of understanding that what goes on outside the gym is an integral part of how successful we're going to be when we're trying to lift that weight. And it doesn't mean that we discover terrible things about ourselves. It may be things that we've known partially, but we've never really seen what it gives rise to in our life, how it affects our relationships, until we started to look closely, to see clearly, and to be honest with ourselves. So someone was giving me an example of this. They were telling me about being in a traumatic situation, and an unhappy situation for the people that they care about. And they said that because they've been meditating for a while now and putting a lot of effort into it, that they can go into that situation with their friends and family in this traumatic situation, and for a little while they can maintain their mindfulness and they can really be aware of what's going on and trying not to fall into old habit patterns of looking for someone to blame for why this problem is there now, looking to see who can be responsible for this situation. And they said after a while they find that they can't be mindful and they do just fall in to their old habit patterns. And they said, it's really terrible because what I really like is to make everyone happy. And in this situation, I'm trying to be really mindful so I can make everyone happy. And then I lose my mindfulness, I get into my old habit patterns, and then I can't make anyone happy. And so we discussed what it was about trying to make everyone happy in a traumatic situation. Is it possible to make everybody happy in a traumatic situation? If it's a traumatic situation, it's a traumatic situation. Where's the happiness? Now we might say, well, as a practitioner, we learn to accept that difficulties come into our life. And we learn by accepting them that we're able to be more equanimous and then we can deal more skillfully with them. And that's true. But is that what this person was doing? I asked them. And when they looked closely at what they were doing, they realised to deny that it was a difficult situation. They were trying to jolly everyone up and pretend that it wasn't a difficult situation, that it wasn't a painful situation, that in fact it was a situation that nobody really knew how to solve. Maybe it was a situation that it wasn't possible to solve so that everyone could be happy again. Because maybe to be happy, people needed to make quite drastic changes in the way they were living their life. And maybe they weren't ready to do that or able to do that or knew how to do that. So making everyone happy was quite a big task, much more than just trying to jolly them up and be bright in the situation. It actually, first of all, required this person to say, I don't know what to do in this situation. And in fact, it feels terrible. And I don't like that. And when they looked at what they were doing and why they liked to make everyone happy, it was because they couldn't bear to be with the unpleasantness of that traumatic situation. So they were actually trying to deny what the experience was for them. And that meant that they were trying to override what the experience was for others too. And when they looked more closely, they could see a lot of fear and a lot of self-pity. They didn't want to be in that situation, especially in a situation that they didn't have a solution to and which was going to take quite a bit of long-term work, long-term change to solve. And so then we talked about, well, self-pity and fear often come from a feeling of helplessness, a feeling of confusion, a feeling of not knowing, and of thinking that there's something wrong with that. So helplessness can come from having experienced traumas in the past when you were little and you really didn't know what was going on and you really didn't feel that you had a solution and you really didn't feel that you were strong enough to maybe even look after yourself, let alone help other people. And if you felt that and you felt it in a significant way when you were young, then that kind of feeling stays with you. And so any challenging situation, any frightening situation becomes overwhelming. And so one way is to try to make everyone happy and pretend that there's not really any difficulty here. And this is what this person gradually came to understand. By being able to look long enough, see clearly, see deeply enough what was going on in their mind behind that facade of just trying to be the bright and cheerful one, the one who was trying to keep everyone happy. Now, discovering that about themselves meant that they realized they were having to work with something that they hadn't realized completely before. They had an inkling of it. That's why there was this fearfulness, why the self-pity was coming up. Self-pity, even when they had actually lots of resources that they could use to help themselves in that situation. They couldn't access those resources or couldn't recognize them because they were overwhelmed with fear and self-pity. So practicing the path, living a good life, developing wholesome qualities which make the mind brighter and stronger, trying to reduce the situations that stir up the mind, giving up some of the things which one knows arouse the mind, unbalance the mind. Practicing meditation and using the Buddha's teachings, the clear instructions given to develop the mind in meditation, gives rise to this ability to see clearly what's going on in our actual experience. Seeing these things takes place when we're interacting, when we're confronting our life situations, but very often at that time we're not able to fully understand what's going on or to change from our usual way of reacting. And so we take our experience back to the meditation and look at it in our meditation itself. And we may need to do that again and again and again before we really see clearly, before we start to see the causes and conditions that have brought about the situation that we're in and the situation of our personal take on it, our personal reaction to it. The honesty that comes is an essential part, and it comes from the self-confidence of knowing that we are doing our best to unravel this mind, to understand this mind, living a life of integrity, being the best kind of person we can be, gives tremendous self-confidence, self-respect, and that translates into not only the willingness to look honestly, but the energy to do that. Wholesome qualities, when they grow in the mind, bring energy into the mind. They bring lightness and brightness into the mind. And they also affect the body. Now, one of the things you might have experienced in your meditation is that when you're able to focus moment after moment on the meditation object, and the mind starts to relax And then it starts to get brighter, sharper, and a pleasant feeling arises. Very often the body will naturally, without willfully doing it, the body will actually rise up physically. The back will stretch. The shoulders will relax. There's a physical rising up that happens when the mind gets brighter and brighter. And very often when the mind is really relaxed and paying attention only to the meditation object and that pleasant feeling is present, the body feels almost like it's expanding, like it's floating. That's how light it starts to feel. And this effect which can be experienced in the meditation is felt in the body as we start to purify the mind. Not just in meditation, but in the way we live our daily life. First of all, it's all the things that we deliberately do to try to improve, purify the mind, our speech and our behaviour through keeping the precepts, cultivating goodness. But then it's what comes out in our speech and our behaviour through what we see and through what we understand about ourselves and what brings peace and happiness into our life, what helps us to live in harmony with others, and those aspects of ourself, those behaviours, those habit patterns which actually bring suffering, bring discomfort, bring disease. As we see them, as we gradually address them, as we let them go, it translates into a feeling of well-being, physically and mentally. And so the effects of the practice are felt not just in the meditation, but they carry over from the meditation into our daily life. It's very important that we understand where meditation fits in. Otherwise, we can devote ourselves to our meditation and neglect the rest of our life, or we can become fixated on doing retreats and only feel that we can practice when all the conditions are perfect. When we're back in our daily life, we think that's not practice or we can't practice. But in fact, what we're trying to do is bring the practice into every aspect of our daily life. And only when it pays off in that way can we say that it's really beneficial. If it's only helping us to sit on the meditation cushion, well, that's helpful at least. At least it gives us a break. But if it doesn't translate into greater peace and happiness, greater harmony in our daily life, then we're not getting the full value from this spiritual life. And this is the way that we can judge for ourselves whether or not we've got all the components working together. If we are feeling brighter, lighter, happier, if we are starting to see ourselves more clearly, and if that is translating into being able to live our life with more ease and more happiness. So I encourage all of you to think, if you ever had a doubt of this weightlifter, an example which comes from the worldly life, but which is very relevant to what we're trying to accomplish in the spiritual life. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Yes?
Over is impermanent.
Yes. So the question was, if we're facing a difficult situation, is it helpful to keep saying that all of these things are impermanent and they will pass? Is that helpful? Yes, it's helpful definitely to remind ourselves that all that is unpleasant that we're experiencing is impermanent, but it's not much comfort if we try to do it only when we're in a very difficult situation. It's much more beneficial if our understanding of that is from a deeper level. And so before we get into difficulties, we start to observe, is it true that everything, the pleasant and the unpleasant, is impermanent? In our meditation practice, when the mind wanders away, and we might think, well, that's wrong, or it shouldn't do that, or I'm still not good at this meditation. If we can just realize, hey, I'm seeing one of the things that the Buddha's always on about, that everything changes. This mind is constantly wandering away because it's constantly changing. This breath that's coming in and out is constantly changing. Ah, I finally get it. Yes, it means this breath and this body. And then we start to see, well, is that true of other people's bodies? And is that true of other things in my experience? And is it true of the thoughts and feelings that come? So to make impermanence work for us, so it's a refuge when things are difficult, we need to be able to apply it to every aspect of our life, and particularly when things are good. Because we lose the balance of our mind when things are pleasant, because we think they're going to stay like that, and then we get so disappointed when they don't. Or we run ourselves ragged trying to keep them as they are when it's their nature to change. So if we have a more balanced view, we can appreciate them while they're there, enjoy them, but also let them go. If we tell someone who's in a difficult situation, don't worry, it'll all be gone soon or whatever, we have to be careful that we're speaking from a real understanding of that ourselves, not just trying to be helpful and pretending that whatever that person is experiencing isn't difficult for them. So we recognize that even if things are impermanent, they're also difficult very often. It's going to be different each time, and that's one of the things to notice again. Oh, gee, this feeling didn't come back. I must have done something wrong. But to recognise, this is what they mean, impermanent. It's not the same. And this is what they mean, unstable, can't be relied on. And this is what they mean, that various causes and conditions allow something to happen one day, and those causes and conditions, when they change or if they're not present, the same thing doesn't arise the next day. And what we experience is, this means even the mind, which I think I'm in control of, is arising dependent, affected by various other things. So if we've had a really busy day and the mind is exhausted, that will be one of the factors which affect us. If we've had a really successful day and we've been really busy but everything went well and we're on a high, that will affect the mind in meditation. If we've just heard some really bad news, that will affect the mind in meditation. Now, how it affects the mind will be different for each person. If we continue to practice and we develop the practice, if we hear bad news, that can really stir us up and spur us on. I've got to make the most of this meditation now, not waste any more time. If we understand these things come and they can come at any time to anyone and they could come to me, I'm going to make the most of this opportunity now. We might be someone who's not really used to accepting this is the way things are, and bad news might overwhelm us and we might lose all the energy, we might be really flat and we just can't attend to the meditation. So different conditions will produce different results for different people. But the other thing to remember is that if we practice, we make the arising of that pleasant feeling a stronger and stronger pattern in the mind. It becomes something that we can access more easily. We know how to get to that point. We know what works for us, what things are important to help us to get to that point, and what things are counterproductive. And so we try to adjust those things even in the course of our day. We know if we spend a lot of time with a particular people, they really bring us down, or they really get us upset, or they really get us stimulated, or whatever. And so when we're going to meditate, we know, oh, it's good to avoid that, or to reduce that, or to put a bit more of that in. And so we become more skillful at developing these peaceful states, because we know what ingredients bring that about.